Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sweet news for American CEOs, their average pay up 27% last year to $11 million plus. Average American wage earner, not so lucky, pay down last year after inflation. And pensions, more rare and vulnerable than ever. Most workers don't have them, and many corporations that have promised pensions are now trying to walk away. Huge companies have paid their management well, but not put enough aside to cover pension promises. Now those obligations are being dumped on the federal agency charged with backstopping pensions and may someday be dumped on you. The agency's chief says the system is fundamentally flawed and he's quitting. Up next on Point, the exit interview with Bradley Belt on American pensions in trouble. Joining me first today from Washington is John Godfrey, reporter for the Dow Jones Newswires. He's covering the pension bill now being negotiated on Capitol Hill. John, thanks very much for being with us.
A pleasure being with you, Tom.
So the idea is, or was, that Congress would tighten up the rules of how corporations contribute to their pension funds so we wouldn't have these collapsing funds. Is it working?
Well, their efforts so far depends on who you're talking to. I mean, they insist that that pension plans currently are in a tough situation, that if you're too tough too quickly, they'll simply fold their cards and walk away. The White House says that the bills they're considering are way too loose and will let companies get away with the sort of abuses that have led to the current situation.
We read an agency in Washington reporting that the House and Senate bills would lower corporate contributions to already underfinanced pension systems, lower their contributions by another $140 to $160 billion in the next 3 years. Is that true? Are they cutting back on what they're pouring in or required to pour in just as the pensions themselves are in trouble?
Well, again, I mean, this is awfully complicated stuff. So you and I and the vast majority of people listening to this aren't going to be able to discern it, you know, by simply looking at a page and figuring it out. So we got to rely on people like the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
Whose current head we'll speak to in a moment, Brad Belt. Yeah.
Yep. Their opinion is that it will reduce the contributions. That opinion is seconded by Congress's own estimators, the Congressional Budget Office, and peripherally the Joint Committee on Taxation. Both of those are arms of Congress, and they also agree that the number of contributions are going to go down. Now, don't get too hung up on the specific dollar figures. PBGC itself has warned that the numbers are not necessarily accurate because it's based upon a number of scenarios and ifs, but rather it's the direction of the sign and comparisons relative to other proposals that are out there that are important.
You know, of course, the charges are that lawmakers are doing political horse trading here, doing favors for corporations that they're close to go easy on them and what they need to put into these pension funds.
Well, again, I mean, we're in a tough situation. I mean, this really is a crisis. We are at a critical phase for the pension system. And back 20 years ago, about half the workforce was covered by a pension plan of some sort, whether it be a traditional pension plan where you work for X number of years and you get 80% of your top 3 years, or you know your 401k. Fewer got the 401k back then. Now it's more. It's more than half those people covered by a pension plan get a 401k. The problem is that there's just too little money set aside for the defined benefit plans. The stock market hit of 2001 didn't help at all. And now the question is what do you do? You've got too little money set aside for a growing population of retired workers, and how do you fix it? And there's a real fear that if you push too hard, people will simply jump away. I mean, you look at, for example, You mentioned, you know, the airlines.
Yep.
Delta Airlines has a total, according to the PBGC, a total of $18 billion of liabilities for its pension, its various pension plans. It has assets of $7 billion. It's a net underfunding of like $11 billion. It's huge amounts of money, and there's most plans are well funded, but there's a lot of plans out there that are enormously underfunded. So it's a real problem, and it's very difficult.
John, what's going to keep that underfunding from falling on the shoulders of millions of Americans who have no pension benefit guarantee at all, but are going to be paying through the back door the pensions of others when corporations don't?
Well, again, currently, you, I, if we aren't involved in the system, aren't going to pay anything. The way the system is set up is the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is paid by premiums paid by companies with pensions.
But those aren't covering it. It's $23 billion in debt now.
Again, those are long term, and there's a real question about whether that's going to be adequate. Part of the problem is the premiums aren't high enough. Some studies show that instead of the $30 per worker per year, the premiums, that's the insurance premium that a company has to pay,
yep,
should be closer to $120, $130 a year to meet its real, you know, financial benefit.
John, why didn't Congress meet its self-imposed deadline here? It was supposed to solve this by the 7th or by the end of this week. It's done neither. Why not? Why did it fail?
Well, one, there's some real intractable differences. One is just you've got, again, folks in Congress trying to push the bill back towards where the White House wants it, which is tougher funding rules, better disclosure rules, that sort of thing. And you've got people in Congress who are headed the other way, who would like to go easier on companies. Just quickly on that, part of the reason that you've got such a pressure to go easy on the companies is you've got an alliance of labor and management on this issue. Neither one of them is interested in tougher funding rules, because if things get too tough, then they have to end the game, and that's no fun for anybody involved. But you've got, you know, the White House pushing one direction. You've got other people pushing the other direction, so it's a tough issue to resolve. Two, the deadline was sort of an artificial one in the first place. The supposedly there was this, you know, huge hit that people were going to start taking April 15th. Lobbyists used that as a ploy to kind of gin up interest in the bill. Really, this sort of increase in funding that'll hit because of another factor won't take place for another year for the vast majority of plans.
But meanwhile, that underfunding is sitting there and so far under unaddressed in new legislation. John Godfrey, thanks very much for the update.
A pleasure.
John Godfrey, reporter for Dow Jones Newswires. We are talking this hour about the crisis facing American pensions. Joining me from Washington is Brad Belt. He's the outgoing executive director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. That's the ultimate federal backstop for the retirement incomes of 44 million Americans. It is $23 billion in debt. The 2 years Mr. Belt has been head of the agency have been the most tumultuous in its history, with airline, retail, and steel industry bankruptcies falling on the agency. On his watch, he's warned loud and clear that the system is in trouble. He's with us today for his first broadcast sit-down since announcing his resignation last month. Bradley Belt, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Good to be with you.
There's a lot here that we want to understand, but let's start here. You have warned that American taxpayers may end up paying these billions and billions that have been promised but may not be paid by private corporations. Is that a real risk?
Well, it depends on what law is enacted on a go-forward basis. I think John Godfrey outlined the issues quite well. Under current law, it is the companies that sponsor pension plans that are on the hook for losses in the system. They face the prospect of having to pay higher premiums. But as you also noted, those premiums have been inadequate thus far, and substantially so. So that raises the specter that either you place much higher burdens on the companies sponsoring pension plans in the form of higher premiums, or ultimately there may be a risk of Congress being called upon to rescue the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation if we're not able to pay our bills in the future.
We're reading here about $450 billion, nearly half a trillion dollars in underfunding of corporate pension promises. Are you worried that that is all headed toward the American taxpayer, or a significant portion of it?
Certainly the vast majority of that is unlikely to ever come to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. When we released our figures on estimates of the total amount of underfunding in the single employer defined benefit system, that $450 billion, mm-hmm. It should be noted that that's on a termination basis. That would assume that all those pension plans actually did terminate, where that's highly unlikely. While the vast majority of pension plans are, unfortunately, underfunded to some degree, in most cases, the levels of underfunding are modest, and the financial health of the company is such that they're likely to be able to make good on those promises to their workers and retirees. The problem, of course, Tom, is that in too many instances, companies get very deeply in the hole and renege on those promises and shift those costs to third parties.
The third party, at the end of the day, ends up being your agency, which is funded by corporations. But if that doesn't work out, isn't it the taxpayer who's on the hook?
That's the issue. I mean, PBGC, people say, well, the legislation or the administration's proposal is only designed to rescue the PBGC. Understand, we're not a private corporation with shareholders. We're simply a pass-through. We represent the interest of all the stakeholders in the system, including workers and retirees, including responsible companies, and including potentially taxpayers.
Mr. Belt, we really want to understand what's going on here, in part because of the trouble that your agency has run into with all these defaults, I guess, and because this could end up on the shoulders of lots of Americans, and because there are people sitting out there with pensions who don't know if they're going to, you know, be there for them or not, though they're counting on them. You say that the system we have now is, your words, disconnected from economic reality. We followed Alice down the white rabbit's hole. What do you mean, Brad Belt?
There are a number of aspects of the funding rules under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act that allow companies to chronically underfund their pension plans. That's certainly what we saw with regard to United Airlines, which terminated its pension plan with $10 billion more in liabilities than it had assets, and that resulted in a loss of almost $3 billion in promised benefits to workers and retirees at the company, and a hit or losses to the federal insurance program of almost $7 billion.
Chronically and knowingly, are these companies that know they're not putting the money away to cover what they've promised?
Well, that's what the rules allow, and that's the commitment that the Bush administration had made early last year, was to address those most problematic aspects of the funding rules. And this is not just a funding rule issue. There are also some issues you could talk about on the accounting side, but address those most problematic aspects of the funding rules to better ensure that companies are setting aside enough assets to make good on the promises they've made to their workers and retirees. That's really what this is all about at the end of the day, Tom, is ensuring that if a company does get into financial difficulty, the pension plan isn't impacted because there are enough assets there to cover those promises it's made.
Are you leaving your position because the government has not made good on the promise to fix this?
Oh, absolutely not. Clearly, just a completely personal decision on my standpoint. You know, there are a number of individuals, thankfully, who commit their entire careers to public service. I have not been one of those. I had been in public service earlier in my career for the 10 years prior to assuming the helm of the PBGC. I'd been in the private sector. It had always been my intention to return to the private sector. You know, I've said that publicly the PBGC does not have a viable business model. It's one of the reasons we're $23 billion in the hole. Heading the PBGC is not a viable financial model from a personal standpoint.
But you've gone out with a kind of barrage of very pointed criticism, and you've had a very rough 2 years. I mean, you say on the one hand, you say, it strikes me as fundamentally unfair for the American taxpayer to pay the benefits, if they do ultimately, because, you say, the vast majority of American taxpayers do not have access to these plans, the ill-defined benefit pension plan. Most people are out there on their own hook these days, but that's what you're warning of. Why is it so hard to fix this, Brad Belt?
John Godfrey alluded to that in the initial segment. I mean, these are difficult issues. They require a balancing of interest. There are always trade-offs and different considerations that need to be taken into mind. At the end of the day, what we want to do is make sure that companies do fund up to the levels of their promised benefits, but that we give them a reasonable period of time to do that. The administration had said, let's do that over a 7-year period, which is actually contrary to what you might think, given some of the statements that are coming out of the sponsor community, actually longer than is the case for many companies under current law.
So in other words, they're not toughening up. They're not saying pull up your socks. They're being more generous. They're letting them lean longer on the federal backstop.
Under current law, there are some companies that are required to make up their funding deficits in as few as 4 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Other companies get to stretch out those deficits over 30 years. Since too many companies are too deeply in the hole, we've said, let's begin to address that in a responsible and measured way. Let's strengthen the funding rules. Let's get rid of some of the most egregious aspects of current law, like the smoothing of asset liability values, like the use of credit balances to avoid making contributions or taking contribution holidays for years on end.
These are essentially smoke and mirrors that keep companies from actually funding their promises.
There are mechanisms that are available under current law that, yes, allow mm-hmm. companies to avoid making contributions in many cases for years on end.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make the premium structure a little bit more rational, a little bit more actuarially sound, and most importantly, let's increase transparency in this system. Let's make sure that all the system stakeholders, workers and retirees, investors and companies, and even the regulators have access to timely, relevant information so we can all make better decisions.
Does it strike you as odd to see the giant CEO pay packages that we're looking at out there at the same time that pensions are some days seem like dropping like flies around this country?
Tom, that's completely beyond my bailiwick at the PBGC, and thankfully so.
Do you think Congress is stepping up? You've watched their conversation over tightening this. But yet you've pointed out they're looking at loosening, not tightening rules in some corners. Is Congress poised to do the right thing here?
That remains to be seen. We'll have to see what comes out of the conference committee. The Senate and House bills that passed separately, there are a number of differences between those two measures. There were a number of very positive elements to each of those two bills. There are a number of areas where the administration had indicated they could and should be improved. The conferees have been meeting now over a period of weeks to try to resolve those differences. I think they understand what ultimately needs to be done to improve upon current law, and hopefully at the end of the day, that's what we'll see.
Brad Belt, the message in a lot of the corporate communications, sort of the big message, if you step back, is, well, I mean, some of these companies have been in bankruptcy. The message is sort of, we can't afford to make good on our promises. Can it be that some of the biggest corporations in the richest country in the world simply can't afford it? Are we going to see American corporations walking away from pension promises and saying, sorry, the economy's changed, tough luck, that's just the way it goes?
Well, that's certainly been the outcome under current law, given the fact that some companies have been allowed to get so deep in the hole in the first place with regard to the pensions, and then they do get into financial difficulty for any number of reasons, whether it's mismanagement, misjudgment, what have you, or simply competitive pressures. In the case of the steel industry, you saw a new business model arise, the so-called high-tech mini-mills. In the airline industry, it was the growth of the low-cost carriers, the so-called LCCs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are natural things happening in the competitive landscape that are going to kind of force out old business models and new ones are going to emerge. I mean, that's probably a generally healthy thing, even though it can have disruption and dislocation for individual companies, their industry sectors, or their workers and retirees. What the pension insurance program was never designed to be used as is kind of in a backdoor industrial policy that is allowing companies to offload their pension obligations onto others it's simply in order to become more competitive.
Brad Belt is with us. He's the outgoing executive director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. John's calling from Aberdeen, Maryland. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. Mr. Belt makes a number of very good points, I think, in summarizing the problems here, but particularly this last point about the moral hazard or the idea that corporations can offload their pension obligations onto this PBGC corporation
Yeah. Is
important. I think we need to privatize this provision of the insurance or the backstop to the pension promises, and that would do a number of things. It would price the provision of insurance correctly. Currently, the PBGC premiums, as has been noted, are too low. And it would also ensure that there's transparency to the whole process, which would ensure that the beneficiaries, i.e. the employees who are accruing this pension benefit, would have clear information about how much insurance or how much backstop there is to support these long-term benefits.
So, John, you're saying get this away from the federal government, privatize it so that there's perhaps a tougher eye on what's really required here. Brad Belt, how about it?
Well, that very constructive comment has been advanced in the past, and I certainly think there's a lot to that. I mean, there's a number of ways one might accomplish that. You could completely privatize the corporation itself so that it's no longer a wholly owned government corporation. Congress had previously done that with regard to, for example, Sallie Mae, the Student Loan Marketing Association. You can make the rules in which we operate more private-like, and that, for example, relates to the premiums. Right now, PBGC has a very interesting business model. We're not really able to set underwriting standards like a private sector insurer would. We can't adjust premium levels to cover actual or expected claims experience as a private sector insurer would. We have to provide insurance coverage no matter how uninsurable the risk is. We have to continue to provide insurance coverage regardless of whether you pay your premiums or you make contributions into your insurance, into your pension plan. And perhaps most importantly, the insured can cause the insurable event and still collect on the claim. So it makes for a very interesting business model. So if you start to address some of those issues, then you begin to take care of at least some of that moral hazard problem that the caller referenced. He's absolutely right. There's a lot of moral hazard in this pension insurance system, and that's what we, at the very least, we need to address that.
Moral hazard, because if the government's waiting there to bail it out, people may be more tempted than they should be to lean on it. John, thanks for your call. Brad Belt, please stand by. I want to welcome in another voice from Washington. We're joined by Zvi Bodhi, professor of finance and economics at Boston University School of Management, known for his pioneering work on the risks of equity investment. He's paid a lot of attention to this issue. Zvi Bodhi, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
Last October, you stood in front of the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank and said that we're headed toward a doomsday scenario on this private pension, corporate pension front, that the U.S. is heading toward another bailout of government-backed insurers similar to the huge SNL savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. Are we still headed that way, Mr. Bodhi?
Yes, I think that's true. And in fact, I actually think that the whole traditional corporate pension system in this country, which is called a defined benefit system, is essentially on its way out. In fact, I think we've passed the tipping point. And your previous caller's point about privatizing things, in effect, I think that's what's happened. We're moving to a defined contribution system, which is essentially a privatized pension system where each of us is responsible for our own retirement.
So you're stepping way back and saying we've gone from defined pension benefits to 401ks and all the rest, and that's a transition. But I think our caller was saying, why should the federal government be responsible if corporations duck out on their promises?
Well, my answer to that is because the federal government created the problem in the first place by creating a pension insurance system that invites moral hazard. And even to this day, I would say they haven't faced up to one of the central issues, which is that corporate defined benefit plans invest pension assets primarily in the stock market, which is a complete mismatch for the liabilities that they are serving to collateralize.
And in the 90s, when the market was booming, they dumped a lot of money in there on the basis of that growth. They said, we've got enough invested, but of course, it was nowhere near enough.
Not only that, but the plans were overfunded. There were companies that were not allowed to make contributions because the Internal Revenue Service said, you can't make additional tax deductible contributions. You're already overfunded.
Zvi Bodhi, you've said that unless we get really lucky, the taxpayers of this country are going to have to bail out Brad Belt's agency. How big do you think the bill may be?
Oh, it can be very big, but it is dependent entirely on the future of stock prices and interest rates.
Do you see a change in the economy, stock prices or interest rates, that's going to save the PBGC, that's going to take us away from the bailout scenario?
Well, you know, I am not a forecaster, and nobody
isn't that a pretty rosy scenario? Wouldn't it take a pretty rosy scenario to do that?
It'd take a very, very rosy scenario.
Very, very rosy. Robert's calling from Manchester, Michigan. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess I am confused as to why the government allows corporations, and it kind of goes on with what just got stated about overfunding. But, you know, it just seems like they allow a business model that is subject to failure. If you make promises to your employees that you can't maintain, and the government has an insurance program to back that up, then we've kind of set ourselves up for failure by allowing these businesses to underfund these pensions, either through the insurance payments or premiums that they pay or whatever funding they put in.
Absolutely. And you wonder why. Let's ask Brad Belt. Mr. Belt, why did this happen in the first place?
You go back historically, some of this moral hazard was baked in from the very beginning. The genesis of the Employee Retirement Income Security Act and the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation was actually the failure of the Studebaker car company back in December of 1963. Mm-hmm. Now, the final legislation didn't occur for 11 years later, but this was really catalyzed by the United Auto Workers, who understood that their workers were at risk. But rather than them negotiating in the collective bargaining context for full funding of their pension plans, they said, there's another alternative. Let's create an FDIC-like entity for pensions, in which case you do have the government backstop, and instead we're better able to negotiate for higher wages, for health care, other fringe benefits. We are therefore less concerned about how well-funded the pension plans are.
So the unions and the corporate management both had an interest in letting the buck stop ultimately elsewhere.
Well, that's one of the moral hazard elements that we've seen in the system. You look at the United Airlines situation, and I had noted this in congressional testimony. Back in 2002, this was after 9/11, after the pension plan was already well underfunded into the billions of dollars, and after the company was already into some financial difficulties, all airlines were, the company and one of its unions negotiated $800 million of new benefit promises. It was probably a case where, gee, we can't take higher wages, that is current cash, and take that back to the rank and file. But what we can agree on is higher deferred compensation, because that doesn't have to be paid for
right
now. And,
of course, that may only be there in the end if it's American taxpayers, most of whom will not have pensions themselves. Zvi, you were jumping into a couple of points there to enlighten us.
Right. I'm going to try and make this as simple as I can, because one of the problems with this pension issue is that so few people really understand it. It's terribly complicated.
Yep.
The simple point is this. There is a promise that's given that is a fixed promise, and its cost today depends very much on what interest rates are. So the risk factor there is if interest rates go down, the cost of that promise goes up.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the money that is set aside to back that promise and put it is currently in corporate pension plans is invested primarily in the stock market. The main risk factor there is the level of stock prices. There's a mismatch there between those risks. If the assets were invested in fixed income securities, long-term fixed income securities, we would not be facing this crisis now. Pension plans were were way overfunded in 1999. Since that time, interest rates have come down, stock prices have come down. It's called by people in the pension industry a perfect storm.
So, I mean, overfunded if you believe that bubble would go on forever. But as Brad Belt describes it, anybody could have looked and said there's a huge amount of risk there, too much.
Yeah, but the point is, if you're already overfunded, you're not going to raise premiums and you're not going to require additional funding. In fact, the government was saying you can't add additional funding to corporations.
Brad Belt, was the government whistling past the graveyard here when it should have been tougher?
One of the issues that Zvi talks about is the ability to make tax-deductible contributions into your pension plan, and there were limitations on some companies' ability to do that during the late 1990s. Part of the administration's proposal is to allow a greater amount of tax-deductible contributions to be made into the pension plan. Having said that, I do want to qualify one thing Zvi said in that regard, is that actually, based upon our analysis, the vast majority majority of companies, in fact, could have contributed more, notwithstanding these limitations. But they did impact anywhere from 20% to 40% of the sponsor base in any given year. So it certainly was an issue, but it wasn't the principal contributing factor.
Looks as though the system has been played, and now the bill is big. John's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to make 2 points. The one is that the unfunding of the various pension plans that has become endemic has showed up as corporate profits, which has goosed up the price of the stocks, which basically has made a lot of high-level, you know, executives very rich because they've got the options coming out of their ears. So basically that money was transferred from the working people in the corporations to the higher-level executives. The second point I want to make has to do with the FDIC problem that cost the public about $500 billion.
The SNL bailout, yep.
And what happened there is that originally the FDIC was set up to cover $40,000 of losses of an individual investor. And in the dead of night, the chairman of one of the committees in the, I guess it was the House, a fellow by the name of, St. Germain.
Okay.
They suddenly goosed this limit up to $100,000. And every SNL in the country that was taken over by manipulators began to give the most outrageous loans, the highest risk loans ever. And all of this clearly was at the behest of, you know, money that came in to support people in their runs for public office.
We hear it. So the way it's structured really matters, and the bill falls somewhere. We see where you find it falling, John. Thanks for calling. Let me get a call from Columbia, South Carolina, and Linda. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi. Mine is pretty similar. I'm a taxpayer out here, and what I see is I see corporations making unbelievable amount of profits, some obscene profits, and yet I also see these same corporations putting tons of money into these political leaders who in turn are saying, yes, it's okay, the taxpayers can get taken again and let them take over these pension plans, and then once again, the taxpayer loses. And that's, I'm an American taxpayer out here, and that's what I see. All I see is corporations making more and more and more, and the American taxpayer losing.
Linda, let me ask you, do you have a guaranteed pension?
No, I don't.
If you end up paying for millions of other people's, the little minority who still has them, how are you going to feel about that?
I'm not going to feel good about it at all. Because, you know what? For what? For the corporations to make more profit? For the corporations to take their profit to then support their political leaders who are going to help them make more profit? Where does this all stop, and when does someone care about the American public?
Linda, we hear it. Thanks very much for your call. Zvibody, you can see how easy it is to interpret what's going on in that way. You point out that the unions were in on this at the beginning, too, so it's not just a management deal. But what about Linda's critique? And she's not the only...
Totally correct in the following sense. The government, the taxpayers, represent to every interest group in the country an unlimited cookie jar. They all want to raid the cookie jar. And, you know, Brad Belt has the worst job in the world.
For another 6 weeks.
For another 6 weeks, because he's guarding the cookie jar. There's no one else. Congress isn't going to do it because they want it. You know, they've got to please the special interest groups in the airline industries and other industries that are failing. So they want there to be a government subsidy. The unions want to bail out for obvious reasons because their members are, in general, union members, you know, have pensions.
Mm-hmm.
And so on down the line. So who is there to represent the general taxpayer?
Brad Belt, speak to that taxpayer, Linda, and all the others listening, you know, who want the right thing done here, probably not to disregard pension promises, but also not to be saddled with burdens that rightly belonged elsewhere. Zvibo says you've got the toughest job, maybe the worst job in the world, trying to keep everybody out of the cookie jar. What can American taxpayers, citizens, do to try and keep it straight up, to try and reduce the moral hazard here?
Well, first, as to the worst job in the world, I there's nobody I have higher regard for in this policy arena than Zvi Bode, although I would not say it's a terrible job. I think, indeed, it's an extraordinary honor and privilege to be able to represent the interest of workers and retirees, of companies that act responsibly, and taxpayers as well in serving the public interest in what is a critically and increasingly so important role in heading the PBGC.
Well said, but we note you're leaving.
But having said that, there certainly are risks in the system, and that's what President Bush has been trying to address, to make sure that at the end of the day we don't have a repeat of the savings and loan crisis back from the late 1980s, that we have in place responsible rules and regulations that will allow the worst abuses under current law to be rectified, but to try to address these flaws over a reasonable period of time, so that we don't chase all the good actors, though that is those companies that can make their pension promises, meet their pension promises, don't chase them out of the system. If I'm wearing my PBGC hat, a business hat, the last thing you'd want to do is chase out all your best premium payers from the system. If I'm wearing my national public policy hat, pushing people out of defined benefit plans into DCs may not be the answer either, because the one thing that defined benefit plans do very effectively is mutualize longevity risk, the risk that we will outlive our resources.
Sort of spread it around, but there's got to be enough money in there to cover what's promised. V, let me ask you, Brad Belt says President Bush is trying to do the right thing here, but his party has not got this through Congress, doesn't seem to be tightening it up, and hasn't brought anything to the fore. Are you confident Congress will fix this?
I'm confident they won't, because even within the administration, it's really only the U.S. Treasury that's on the side of the angels, in my judgment. I think every other branch of government wants to raid the cookie jar.
And Brad Belt, a final thought. The Treasury Secretary John Snow is seen as having his head on the chopping block recently. How's Treasury come into this?
Well, Treasury is one of the key economic policymakers, and Treasury Secretary Snow is a member of the PBGC board. But to Zvi's point, I would hasten to note that both President Bush and Vice President Cheney have come out more recently fairly strongly in saying that corporate America needs to step up to the plate and make good on the promises they've made to their workers and retirees. This is a message that's coming straight from the top.
If it gets done, Zvi Bode, call it for us. What are the odds here that this ends up a taxpayer bailout, in a nutshell?
I'd say that it will be, but it'll be stretched out over many years, and it's part of the legacy costs of our old system. We are moving to a completely different type of pension system in the future.
The old way, going away fast and leaving a big bill behind as it goes. Zvi Bode, Professor of Finance and Economics at Boston University School of Management, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Brad Belt, we appreciate the exit interview. You give us a lot of insight here. Thanks for your time at the wheel there. We wish you well as you head out.
Thank you very much, Tom. A pleasure to be with you.
Brad Belt, outgoing executive director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. You get the picture. In a moment, the latest on the Scooter Libby leak investigation. This is On Point. Another voice has joined the chorus demanding an explanation of the president and vice president's leaking of classified CIA information on Saddam Hussein and the Iraq War. Yesterday, on Fox News Sunday, Republican Senator Arlen Specter said Bush and Cheney should, quote, tell the American people exactly what happened. The White House has been on the offensive, defensive, since news surfaced last week that Scooter Libby, Cheney's former chief of staff, testified before a grand jury that President Bush had approved Vice President Cheney's instructions authorizing him to leak classified information on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Libby has been charged with perjury for his alleged role in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Keeping a close watch on these developments is Michael Isikoff, investigative reporter for Newsweek magazine. He joins me now from Washington. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
It's a confusing story. Where's the bottom line here of responsibility, Michael Isikoff?
Good question. Here's what we know. As we reported this week in Newsweek, the president did, in fact, and we have official confirmation of this, authorize the vice president, Dick Cheney, in late June, to disclose portions of the national intelligence estimate. Get it out were the instructions that Bush gave Cheney. This was a general declassification, verbal, no memorialization as far as we know.
No memorialization, meaning what?
Not written down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The president, at his whim, has the discretion to disclose any classified information he wants to.
If he can legally do that, what's the problem here?
Well, the problem is as a result of the... the president, by the way, did not instruct who should do the leaking or whom should be the recipient of the leak. That was left to the vice president. Then the vice president has a conversation with Scooter Libby, the result of which is Scooter Libby then discloses verbally again portions of the NIE to Judy Miller of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is this. What Scooter Libby did was not a he did not give a document or the actual contents of the NIE. He selectively disclosed portions of the NIE and misrepresented them to Judy Miller. So, for instance, he told Judy Miller that there had been a finding in the NIE that Saddam Hussein's government had been seeking yellow cake uranium from the African country of Niger. This was, of course, the basis for the 16 words.
In the State of the Union address, helping justify the war in Iraq.
Right.
Yes.
And what he said is he was authorized to disclose the key judgments of the NIE. Well, that the yellow cake uranium matter was never a key judgment of the NIE. It was never a finding of the NIE. It was mentioned in the NIE and in the context of other reporting, but in fact, there was also a very firm dissent in the NIE from the State Department saying they were highly dubious of this report.
So there's a
that
leak from a...
That was not mentioned to Judy Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And so what... So, in effect, this classified document, the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq, was misrepresented in a misleading way to Judy Miller of the New York Times. So the result of the president's authorization was, in fact, you know, arguably the political manipulation of classified intelligence in order to bolster the White House's position politically.
So you've got a leak from the commander-in-chief who says he hates leaks, and then the leak is spun to help justify the administration's position on the war, maybe unjustifiably. What are the consequences of this going to be, if any?
It's not clear there are any legal consequences because, as I said, the president, at his whim, can disclose anything he wants. Certainly there have been political consequences because it does raise the question of hypocrisy. Was the administration, in fact, spinning intelligence in Iraq? And that has been, you know, an ongoing political controversy as the Iraq war has become less and less popular with the American public.
And Michael Isikoff, we've just got 20 seconds here. Might this help Scooter Libby get off on the charges against him?
Not clear that it's going to help. In fact, it could cause a bit of a rift between Libby and the president now. At the end of the day, I think a lot of people think Libby's ultimate goal is a presidential pardon. This could make it more difficult.
Michael, thanks very much for joining us.
Anytime.
Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. His story, Leaker in Chief, appears in the current issue. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.